Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance here at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he is here and we talk about investing in money management. And the way that we do this, when I say we, I guess I should say he, the way he does it, is open up with some comments. And then if people who are listening have questions about that or anything else about financial planning, money management, give us a call, and I know he will do his best to help you out. And with that, we'd say welcome back. Good morning. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Now, the subject of my opening remarks is really based upon the following excerpts from an email that was forwarded to me from a WILL listener. In fact, David, you and I were talking a little bit about it off the air just this morning. It says, I've got the following question for guest David Sinnoh. We are in the process of preparing a will to take care of our two young children in the unlikely event that my wife and I both pass away at the same time. The attorney suggests a trust naming the children as beneficiaries, essentially of all of our assets, our life insurance, our IRAs, our pension plans, our 403b programs, etc. Would you mind explaining what happens to these various sources of money left in a trust for their care? And would you mind explaining the difference between something called the one-year rule and the five-year rule, which really has to do with taxes? Okay, that's a bit of a complicated question, and it's, of course, a bit of a complicated answer, but I'm going to try to explain it, so if everyone can hang with me, it'll take about 3 or 4 minutes to try to explain these issues, which are extraordinarily important issues, I might add, faced by many, many parents who have young children and who especially have IRA programs, 401k programs, pension programs at work. Now, the commonly asked question is whether or not to designate your trust, and it's usually called a revocable living trust, as the beneficiary of a retirement account, and really, what are the tax consequences of doing so? In the overwhelming majority of cases, my recommendation to clients is that they name their spouse first as the primary beneficiary of all of their retirement plans, including their life insurance. All right? So if husband passes away or wife passes away, then essentially everything is received by the spouse. And interestingly enough, in almost all cases, all of those assets received by the spouse are going to be received estate tax-free, and to the extent there are income tax consequences, generally the retirement plans can be rolled over income tax deferred to the named spouse. So we name the spouse first as the primary beneficiary, and then the trust is named as the secondary, or often referred to as the contingent beneficiary. Financial advisors, however, frequently inform clients that by doing so, the entire balance in the retirement account will be taxable upon the participant's death. If the beneficiary is a trust, it's all taxable. I want to dispel the rumor that is not the law. It has not been the law for several years. The advantages of naming the trust as a contingent beneficiary, as opposed to naming your children directly as the IRA beneficiaries, include several advantages. First, the trustee can control the age of distribution for the children. This is especially important with minor children, young adults, or children who don't wisely spend their money, often referred to as spendthrifts. Second, the trust can define where any beneficiary share will go if the beneficiary unfortunately dies before receiving their entire share. Third, keeping a beneficiary share in trust can preserve its status as sole and separate property in the event of some nasty disputes with a potential spouse. And four, keeping a beneficiary share separate in trust can protect it also, interestingly enough, in many cases, in many states, from creditors. Lots of advantages. Now, a participant in a retirement account, whether it's an IRA, whether it's a pension plan, whether it's a profit-sharing plan, etc., may designate an individual, like your spouse, to be the beneficiary, or someone else to receive those assets at the death of the owner. And the rules relating to a trust as the beneficiary have changed over the years. But what I want you to remember is that if you name the trust as the secondary beneficiary and the children are essentially the beneficiaries of that trust, there is a no immediate tax impact. This is because the rules changed several years ago, and if we have the trust as the designated beneficiary for minimum distribution purposes, no immediate tax. In the olden days, all of the money would have been taxed within 1 year. It had to be pulled out, and all of those assets would have been taxed. And again, that was called the one-year rule. That's simply not the case anymore. It is out of date. Today, if certain requirements are met, the beneficiaries of this trust, in other words, the children, may be treated as what are called designated beneficiaries, and the trust then may defer the liability of the distributions in exactly the same manner as if the children were named outright as the beneficiaries. So if we're careful, the trust can enjoy the same benefits as naming minor children as the beneficiaries of these tax-deferred instruments. The requirements are really quite simple. One, the trust document itself must be valid under state law. So here's the bottom line. If it's drawn correctly, if you typically have an attorney drawing it, it's going to be valid under state law. Two, the trust must be irrevocable, can't be changed, or at least become irrevocable at the death of the individual who started the IRA, the pension plan, the 401k. The trust beneficiaries must be identifiable in the trust instrument. So if I set up a trust, I've got to name beneficiaries, like my children. Those are named beneficiaries. And finally, either a copy of the trust instrument or an affidavit must be filed with the plan administrator of the plan within a year after the participant's death. So if I die, I name as a contingent beneficiary my children, and it's really embedded inside a trust, then that trust document must be filed with the plan administrator, assuming I don't have a surviving spouse. So for tax purposes, because the trust is being ignored essentially, and the trust beneficiaries are being considered as the designated beneficiaries, then they must be individuals. That's important to remember. If you set up one of these revocable trusts and the revocable trust becomes the beneficiary of these plans, then the beneficiaries must be individuals, not charities, not businesses, etc. Now, if the owner dies, all right, if the plan person who's got this money in a 401k, a 403b, a defined benefit, a pension plan, an IRA plan, if that owner of that money essentially dies prior to reaching 70 and a half, and the contingent beneficiary, which is going to receive this money, is a trust, and there are no spouses involved here, so we aren't leaving money to spouse, then the remaining amount in these plans gets distributed under the following rules. It must be distributed either by the fifth year following the owner's death or sooner. You could just distribute it all and hand it to the children, who are essentially the beneficiaries. Or it must be distributed by the end of 5 years following the year of the owner's death. Or a better mousetrap is to make the distributions over the life expectancy of the beneficiaries of the trust. That's usually the best mousetrap. So we've got husband and wife with minor children. Husband and wife have substantial assets in a 401k, a 403b, some type of pension plan. Unfortunately, husband and wife die. The assets then inure to the contingent beneficiary, which is this trust. The children are the beneficiaries of the trust. The trustee of the trust could say, here, take it all right now, probably a bad idea. All of those assets then would be subject to tax, income tax. A second mousetrap, well, we'll distribute it 5 years from now. But at the end of 5 years, whatever is distributed, subject to tax. The best mousetrap, let's wait and let's distribute it over the actuarial lives of the oldest child. So if we've got one child who's 14 and one child who's 8, we use the oldest child for purposes of determining how much money must be distributed each year. And basically, that's a very, very tiny amount of money based upon the actuarial life expectancy of a minor child or a child, for that matter. So it could be distributed over a long, long period of time. And those assets continue to grow. And only the minimum distribution then is subject to income tax. I know that sounds complicated, but that's the way the game is essentially played, which is really telling you that you need somebody who understands these rules. You've got to work with competent legal counsel if you are going to set this up where you say, first of all, thank goodness I've got a surviving spouse. He or she is my primary beneficiary. But if I don't have a surviving spouse, or if we die in a common accident, then I'm going to name this trust as my contingent beneficiary. And really, who benefits? Well, my children, who are actually beneficiaries of the trust. So there is a lot of flexibility built into this rule. By the way, if you distribute the money at the end of 5 years, that's called the 5-year rule that the listener and the emailer was asking us about. So the bottom line, primary beneficiary, spouse first, contingent beneficiary, your trust, and there is all kinds of flexibility built into that program. Finally, the next thing I'd like to do, which we're now doing each month, is to talk very, very briefly about the couch potato portfolio. And I believe the numbers will be updated this week on the WILL website. I provided the numbers through today, and look, in the next few days, they will be updated. Well, you'll recall, this is basically a passive portfolio of index stock funds. I'm not suggesting that you put all your money into this couch potato portfolio, but it is one sensible mechanism for investing in the stock market with a portion of your money. I use it. I use it for my spouse, my children, etc. So that's all I can tell you. I'm not going to suggest something that I don't do myself. 10% of my dollar is in the S&P 500. 16.5% of my dollar is in large value, 10% small cap, 16.5% small cap value, 10% mid cap, 30% approximately international, 5% emerging markets, 20% total international index, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The point is, David, it's available on the website, the actual asset allocation. Through yesterday's close, from January 1 forward, through yesterday's close, inclusive of dividends, minus expenses, that portfolio is actually up 5.47% for the year. Am I jumping up and down? You bet. That's a pretty decent return because last month, the portfolio was only up 0.08%. So in the last 30 days, as most of us know, the stock market's been on fire. It seems to be on fire again today. And the market in this portfolio has moved up some 5.4% just in the last 30 days. How do we compare to our benchmark S&P 500? Because we've got to have a benchmark to compare our portfolio against. Regardless of where you're investing, whom you are investing with, you've got to ask your advisor, what's our benchmark for our portfolio? How are we doing compared to our benchmark? Our benchmark, the S&P 500. All right, that's a pretty easy benchmark. Through yesterday's close, inclusive of dividends, the Vanguard Index 500 up about 4.2%. So we're running about 1.3%, called 125 to 130 basis points ahead of the S&P 500. So stay tuned. That's all I can tell you about that portfolio, and I'm sure it will be updated on your site just in the next few days. And David, you might tell the audience how we access that.
Right. Well, if you go to the WILL webpage, it's very easy. Go to the main webpage, then click on AM, then click on Focus 580, then click on Links, and it will be there. And Dave asked me about it, and I just looked at it, and the last time it was updated was
last month. Sure.
So, and I'm sure that by the end of the day, we'll get that done. And I have several people here with questions, so let's get to that. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance here at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month, he's here on this program on a Friday to talk about personal finance. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana folks here in the local area. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll start with our first caller here on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I know that this is certainly, I don't think that you would recommend at all. In terms of hedge funds, is this the next sort of the housing market thing in terms of something you think will crash or get hurt or whatever or not?
Well, let's talk about what a hedge fund is, because most people misunderstand what a hedge fund is. A hedge fund typically is a private pool of money getting together that is often unregulated. Most funds are regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States. Hedge funds are generally unregulated pools of money pursuing a very specific strategy. That strategy may be to be highly leveraged, borrow all the money to take on a position. It may be short selling the stock market. It may be arbitraging between treasuries. There's probably 10,000, maybe 50,000 different strategies. But a hedge fund, first and foremost, is generally an unregulated pool of money. And it's looking for substantially higher rates of return than the stock market will generally participate and deliver to its investors. So it is speculative. They come and go every day. But we don't hear about a lot of them because, again, this is in the private sphere, not in the public sphere. And the good ones get reported, but the bad ones you never hear about. So here's the bottom line for an individual. I'm not in hedge funds. I think that probably tells you enough. And if you're going to go into a hedge fund, I feel more comfortable if the players in the hedge fund have an SEC-regulated hedge fund and the amount of money that you place in a hedge fund is a tiny, tiny percentage of your overall net worth. So do hedge funds crash and burn? You bet they do. How many succeed? We really don't have good data on that information because, again, most of this is private money. Hedge funds are particularly, well, what kinds of groups are particularly interested in hedge funds? Pension funds, small amounts of money, even charitable foundations, etc. Mostly institutional players or individuals with very, very substantial net worths who really are understanding the bet that they're making. But again, even these organizations and institutions are taking very, very small amounts of money and placing them into hedge funds.
And another question, in terms of what's the current inflation rate? It's bumped, hasn't it? Hasn't it gone up?
Well, the current inflation rate is quoted every day in the Wall Street Journal under money rates. And let me pull it out for you as of yesterday, April 18th, 2007. Now, these statistics come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, our own government. So you have to take them with a little bit, of a grain of salt? All right. So the U.S. Consumer Price Index change through March of 2006 is already up for all items, up 2.8%.
Mm-hmm.
So over the last year, and core inflation up 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, between you, me, and the Great Post, I pretty much think that we're paying a little bit more than 2.8% for a whole lot of items.
Mm-hmm.
I know that gasoline is up more than 2.8% from a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I know that clothing and food and drinking a glass of milk is up a whole lot higher. And the cost of a college education and medicine is a lot higher. But those are the reported retail numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You can find them each day in the Wall Street Journal, typically under Section C, under something called money rates.
And then finally, just to comment on the stock, what's the big growth? I don't know. It doesn't seem like our economy is growing to that extent in terms of this, the big push in the stock market.
What's pushing the stock market?
Yeah.
Probably a couple of things. Pretty level interest rates. We haven't had spikes of interest rates for a number of months. And then recently, better than expected earnings of these particular companies. And in the end, when everything gets said and done, stocks are driven by their earnings. The more earnings, the more dividends. The more dividends, the happier you and I are. So price is really a function of earnings of a company. And we've had a lot of surprises to the positive side, as reported in the first quarter of 2007. And I think that's really driving stock prices. And remember, even though day to day there's lots of fluctuations, there's lots of issues in the foreign markets, etc., the bottom line is basic economics of companies drive prices of stocks.
Okay, well, I want to thank the caller for the question. Let's go to next, someone on a cell phone north of Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to the trust subject you were discussing and talk about a specific case, and because I think it would give your the listeners an idea of how even more complicated than your description it actually turns out to be. And I'm going to talk about someone I know, so this will be the proverbial friend. Their father, who had two daughters, died with about 6 months ago, and they left in a state of $20 million. And that money was put into a trust in his name, and then divided into trusts for to be distributed equally in trusts for the two daughters. And those daughters were to receive. They didn't have control. They weren't the trustees. They were the beneficiaries of the trust that was set up for them. Okay, and. The first thing that happened was that the IRS came in, and they wanted to evaluate everything.
Well, I'm just going to stop you.
Okay.
That clearly, at when someone dies,
yeah.
At that point in time, for any estate that basically today is in excess of a couple of million dollars, if you're not going to file an estate tax return, but you must after the couple of million dollars, then everything is valued at fair market value at the date of death. So IRS is going to come in absent appropriate appraisals on all of the assets,
right.
Valuing them at fair market value at the date of death. Okay.
People need to realize that the IRS can take up to 3 years to finish that evaluation. And that what happened is the trustees of the father's trust would not take money out of the father's trust to give all of it to the two children's trust because they had to hold some back in case the IRS said, we don't like this evaluation. There's a property here we think is worth more. You're going to have to give us more money. So they weren't satisfied to just take $4 million right off the top. So there's a lot of money, and it's still sitting around in the father's trust, and it can take, as I said, this is what the IRS said, up to 3 years before they say whether they're satisfied or not. So you shouldn't think that money is going to go to you right away. There has to be money held back.
Well, there's no question about that. However, the children would have faced the same problem.
Absolutely.
The children would have faced the same problem because there seems to be a disagreement over valuation, which is a different issue altogether. And IRS can contest valuation. Often, it is contested over the value of closely held business stock. Is that what is involved here? Because
no, property.
Property?
Everything. There's everything involved. Anything you could possibly own. Stocks.
Well, stocks have a legitimate price.
Right. But property evaluation, is you have to be very, very careful about that. If you, let's say it's evaluated, and then you sell the property later on at a higher price, the IRS can come in and see whether there was a fix going on where it was underestimated. You know, that's a possibility, and that can cause another reevaluation.
Yeah. So the safest thing to do in these cases is to have what are called MAI appraisals on the real estate. Those are generally accepted by the IRS. That's number one. Obviously, publicly traded stocks and securities have a fixed price. We know the fair market value on the date of death. It's a much more difficult problem, as you mentioned, with closely held business stock and or some issues of real estate. And you are right, IRS can come in and hold things up, but that's really not a problem with the trust. That's a problem with IRS in terms of valuation, whether it goes to the children or not. Mm-hmm. Now, the trustee could probably hold back 50% or more. And does the trust allow for outright distributions to these children?
Yes.
Okay, so the children are waiting for not only income from the trust, but principal as well.
Yes, well, they got some. And not only that, what they did get, and not equally, one's getting a percentage of the trust that was set up for her, and the other one controls her own trust. Okay, there's issues involved there with the family. But the point is they just found out, that they now have to pay quarterly state money. And they have to be really careful that the trust is withholding for payments, because they just found out that they had to pay the state where the trust is established. That's where the father died. They have to pay the state of Illinois. And they have to pay the IRS. And they have to do these quarterly, I'm not sure what they're called, the ones where you pay quarterly.
Sure. Well, I think we have to understand, though, we're talking about a very, very tiny percentage of the U.S. population where we're talking about $20 million plus estates. I'd be happy to be a beneficiary and hassle with the IRS over that. What a wonderful problem to frankly have. But you're absolutely right. The IRS is going to look a lot more closely. It's going to scrutinize issues when we have these kinds of dollars involved, which means that we've got to have very, very competent counsel who have drawn these documents in the first place and understand and explain all of these ramifications to the various stakeholders, which obviously include trustees, beneficiaries, and the original grantor of the trust. So thank you so much for this update.
Yeah. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I have another caller who's been waiting patiently. We want to get to them. Dave Sinnoh is our guest. He's a clinical professor of finance here at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance, money management. If you have a question, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Line 3 is next in Urbana.
Hello?
Yes.
I have a quote from an author that I'd like you to comment on. The author's name is Michael Edesis, and the book is called The Big Investment Lie. And he says, professional investors are no more skilled at investing than the average person. If you invest through a large company, you are likely to lose half of what you could earn. Can you talk about that?
I simply just flat out disagree.
Uh-huh.
I just flat out disagree. First of all, unquestionably, many of us are certainly sophisticated enough to invest on our own. I've given a portfolio that all of you are perfectly capable of, who are listeners of WILL, who have the intellectual capital to set this kind of program up. I think what the author is really getting at is you've got to be very, very careful about expenses that a professional advisor charges.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that if you on your own were earning 8, but if your advisor had you in the identical assets and charging 1%, you're now earning 7. And the difference between 7 and 8 over a short period of time doesn't mean a whole lot. But the difference between earning a net of 7% annually compounded versus 8% compounded over long periods of time is really a huge amount of money. It's literally scores of thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And those are dollars that are going into the pockets of Wall Street, and they should be going into the pockets of Main Street. And that is really what I really am very concerned about for the average investor, and that is to control fees. For example, there's been all kinds of studies done, all kinds of articles in the popular press talking about indexed annuities, annuities that invest in stocks, variable annuities. And when we really dissect these products, what we find out is that the expense ratio annually on these products is often in excess of 3%. That's enormous expense. That's 3% that should be going into Main Street investors' pockets, not the insurance companies. And that literally adds up to tens and tens of thousands of dollars over long, long periods of time. However, many people, in fact, the majority of people in the United States, want someone to hold their hand. They don't need any hand-holding when the stock market is going up. But you can bet that they want lots of hand-holding, I guess that's the word, isn't it, when stocks are going down. Someone who can counsel them. And that's when they need not to get emotionally involved and jettison their portfolio. Because one out of every 4 years, according to stock market history, that's inevitable when stocks go down. We don't know how much they're going to go down, but they go down. And you simply can't do anything about that. That's called being invested. It's the systematic risk of investing in stocks. And that's really when people want professional investors to hold their hands. But for listeners of WILL, for my money, I think most of them can do an extraordinarily good job by simply being passive investors in a stock market portfolio, but at the same time, recognizing that they must have fixed income. I'm not suggesting you put all your money into this basket, so that they have a proper allocation between stocks and fixed income. And I know you personally are able to do this because I know you're a savvy investor and you're perfectly capable of watching over your own portfolio. So those are my comments about that particular book, about that particular author. I think it's a little overstated, and many, many people want a professional investor, but watch the fees that the professional investor is charging.
Okay. Well, it was kind of a scary thing to read, but thank you for your help.
All right. Thanks. I think just again to underscore that it sounds like maybe the person is talking about the kind of advisor who would perhaps advise you to invest in individual stocks.
Maybe individual stocks or load mutual funds, which are heavily commissioned. I'm not a fan of load mutual funds where you're paying a commission either going in or going out. That's called a rear-end surrender charge. Not excited about that. And you know, for the average investor, it's very, very difficult to put together an individual stock portfolio, which essentially does away with something called unsystematic risk. That's the risk of just holding a stock, whether it's IBM or Enron, and watching it go up and then maybe going down and not returning. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. That's called unsystematic risk. You need to hold a certain number of issues. You need a savvy investment advisor to be able to put that kind of portfolio together for you.
Yeah, and so that's the beauty of the mutual fund.
Absolutely.
It spreads your risk out over many stocks, many more stocks than you as an individual could possibly buy. You can't do that yourself, but by investing in, say, an S&P 500 fund or, you know, whatever kind of fund it is. And that's what the couch potato portfolio is. It's a collection of funds. The idea is to spread your money as much as possible among big companies, small companies, foreign companies, U.S. companies, emerging companies, companies that have been around forever. The idea is you put a little bit in every one of these so that if any one of them takes a big dive, the rest of them should pretty much be.
That's correct. Okay. David, you're preaching to the choir because you don't want these asset classes to be perfectly correlated. You don't want them to all go up because then they all go down at the same time. And interestingly enough, if we look at the mathematics of the portfolio, by adding these additional asset classes, even something as volatile as emerging markets around the world, which can go up a lot and go down a lot, it actually has the impact of reducing the overall volatility of the portfolio. And one of our objectives is to reduce portfolio volatility, which simply means in those inevitable periods of time when markets fall, our portfolio falls less. The less volatile our portfolio is, the less likely it is to take those huge dives. which happened to people in 2000, 2001, 2002, because they just love those high-tech stocks, and they were not properly diversified.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, again, you have questions about your own financial situation. You'd like to get some advice. Of course, we want you to get as much advice from as many different sources as possible. This would be one. Call in, and you can talk with Dave. Dave Sinnoh is clinical professor of finance at the U of I. Once a month, he's here on the program. We talk about investing and money management. We have maybe about 15 minutes left. Someone next to talk with in Rossville. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question here. We're trying to do some estate planning. And how can we explain this to our children, or is it a good thing to live around 400 acres of farmland and leave it their lifetime income, or is that a good idea or not? I'll hang up and listen to you on the radio. Thank
you. Hang on one second. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, can you repeat that question? I didn't quite catch it.
Well, I was trying to set up our estate, and we have over 400 acres of farmland, and the value, we want to leave the income to our children their lifetime in a trust, go to our grandchildren. Is that a good plan or not?
Well, it depends upon what you want to accomplish and what type of assets the children already hold. Now, I can tell you that, so you need to go to a savvy estate planner who can lay out the estate tax consequences of giving a life estate, essentially an income estate, to the children, and then the remainder entrance to the grandchildren. It's sort of like a generation-skipping trust is what you're suggesting, and you need to go to a lawyer who can lay that out on paper and show you exactly what the tax consequences are. Another mousetrap, just to consider, something that you should talk to your estate planner about, is the possibility of conveying your 400 acres of farmland today into a limited liability company. And then gifting, that, by the way, that's a tax-free change. You're just simply conveying your assets that you own or you and your spouse own into your own fully owned limited liability company. You then can break that limited liability company into units, and you can actually gift units of your limited liability company to children and or grandchildren, but you can remain the managing members of the limited liability company and determine how that income is shared. Each year, by gifting units in the partnership, you are essentially reducing potential estate taxes down the road through this gifting mechanism. And it is often used by the farming community, other people who hold real estate, as a mechanism over a large number of years to pass assets to other generations, children and grandchildren, and ameliorate the impact of estate taxes down the road. So while you are considering different possibilities with your estate planner, and I really don't have an opinion about whether this is a good idea to give an income interest to children and then essentially a remainder interest to grandchildren, I'd have to know a whole lot more about your situation as well as the children's situation to really give you a dispositive answer about that. Make certain you talk to your estate planner about this concept of a limited liability company and then gifting units with your maintaining control of the company, which then holds the farmland. So that's sort of the short, the long, and the narrow, and the wide of that answer.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right,
my pleasure.
You. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Obviously, the kinds of things we're talking about doing estate planning can be very complicated, depending upon how much money you're talking about and what the assets are and what form they're in, and then how many beneficiaries you have and how you want that to all get worked out. There are attorneys that specialize in that. That's essentially all they do.
No question.
And I suppose the more complex the situation, the more you want to make sure the advice is good and you should expect to pay for that. What's an appropriate cost to get somebody to set something like this up? And it generally, is it a case where you're going to pay people by the hour, or do they also charge based on some percentage of the value of the assets, or how does that work?
Well, that's a great question, and that's a question that you should discuss with your estate planner. But generally, under Illinois law, you're going to be charged an hourly rate. You're not going to be charged based on a percentage of the estate. But still, for a complicated estate, you could be looking at anywhere from $2,500 to $10,000. There's no question about that. There are going to be several hours of time. And to the extent that you provide your estate planner with good data, good appraised values of these assets, that's going to cut down on the bill. Mm-hmm. Any sophisticated estate plan is probably going to include health care powers of attorney, general powers of attorney, a living will, something called a pour-over will into a revocable living trust, and there may be additional trusts on top of that, generation-skipping trusts, etc. So this is a complicated business. At least today, the rules are pretty clear, although the rules are likely to change. Today, if you die and you have an estate of a couple of million dollars or less and you leave it to somebody, there are no estate taxes. Isn't that interesting? But if you leave it through your will, then you're into the probate process, and probate takes time. Whereas if you distribute those assets through a funded trust, there is no probate. It's private. Nobody knows your business. And indeed, in often cases, it's exempt from creditors. So this is a complicated area, and you need to work with someone who knows their business to the extent that you have significant assets and significant questions. And also, even for younger people, the major reason to have at least a simple will is if you've got children, you want to make certain that you have guardianship instructions in that will. Otherwise, the courts will decide on guardianship in the event of you and your spouse's demise. You've got minor children. Somebody's got to decide. So that's a court decision. Hmm. I don't think you want to leave that decision to a court.
Yeah. We have somebody here calling on a cell phone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to know what it is you think I should... Well, first of all, I'm 67 years old, and I have a some I-bonds that I've set up with a income that came from a farm from my grandmother, and I've got about $50,000 in I-bonds. When I'm also in some tax shelters from when I was employed, and when I become 70... I'll have to start taking out 10%, as I understand.
Is that like a deferred comp plan or something? What type of plan is that?
Well, those are just accounts that I bought into, mutual funds.
Okay, but are they inside a tax-deferred instrument, which requires you to start taking at 70 and a half?
I was a teacher, and... You're
probably in a tax-sheltered annuity program, okay?
Well, I'm not sure that it's tax-sheltered. Yeah, okay. Well, they're tax shelters anyway, and I'm not sure. I thought they were
403Bs.
403B.
Right. That's a tax-sheltered annuity program, and at 70 and a half, you're going to start taking minimum distributions.
It's terrible how we don't know what we're doing.
Well, that's, yeah, but at least you admit it. So if you can get some advice. Okay, go ahead.
And I have this about $48,000 in I-bonds that I put that money into. And then I also have another account, totals up about $130,000 between the I-bonds and the other one.
Okay.
In government security, money market. Now, is that a smart thing to do, to leave that in there? Or should I go ahead and get into some kind of stock account with the $48,000 and the other, $60,000, I guess it is.
Do you have any stock currently?
I have all of these, not individual stocks. I have mutual funds.
All right, so the 403B is in stock mutual funds?
Yes.
All right. I think the biggest mistake that people make who are 60, 65 and older is that they end up jettisoning a large amount of their stock positions, and they move to fixed income, thinking that is the conservative, more intelligent thing to do.
and where the money is.
And the problem with that, as you know, is that inflation eats dramatically into fixed income. It's very, very tough. So what I typically recommend is having a percentage of your money at all times in the stock market, but you've got to feel comfortable. And I feel comfortable for a person who's 60, 65 years of age to have anywhere from 35 to 50% of their money in a diversified portfolio of stocks.
That is the case.
And if you are already there, if you have a diversified portfolio of stocks where you essentially are in stock mutual funds, indexes, et cetera, you feel comfortable with them and you have 35 to 50% of your assets in that position, then I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Well, that is where I'm at.
Okay. If that's where you're at, then you really don't need to make a lot of changes other than you might go to an advisor and make certain that your stock portfolio is well diversified.
Yeah. Well, it is. That is the case. And there's two or three companies. Well, thank you very much. Then you would leave it in the I bonds and in the money market then.
I don't have a problem with that so long as it meets your objectives and you have this minimum 35 to 50% in equities.
And then when I take it out, I should probably out of the sheltered, then I just leave it in a similar account.
Well, you could. You could spend it. You could invest it, et cetera. So that's up to you.
Thank you very much.
All right, pleasure.
Thank you. Let's talk with someone in Georgetown, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was listening, and I may be confused from something you said, but I kind of want to clarify something. I own some farmland and right now have a simple will. And am I right? If you want to avoid probate, you need to put it in a trust?
That's correct.
I own under 200 acres of land.
Doesn't matter. 200 acres in today's world is a probatable asset.
Okay.
You don't have a small estate. A small estate affidavit is $50,000 or less of market value and no real estate. Otherwise, your land is going to be subject to probate. And in your particular case, with a couple hundred acres of high-quality Illinois farmland, you would be advised to retitle that into a trust.
Okay.
All right? And then name beneficiaries of the trust. You avoid probate, et cetera. You probably won't have any federal estate tax on that 200 acres unless it goes to $10,000 an acre.
Right.
But it might. It might. I mean, it should probably make you happy.
Depends on how long I live.
Well, hopefully a long time.
Right.
Hopefully a long time.
In other words, the main idea of probate, of course, there is a cost. It's not that. Is it a large cost?
Well, it's not so much the cost.
It's the idea that everybody knows.
One, everybody knows. Two, it takes time. And three, in any probate process, creditors come forward to the extent you have any or to the extent they just show up out of the blue and they can make claims against what is in the probate estate.
Okay.
All right? So if you don't have your farm in the probate estate, then a creditor doesn't come forward and say, oh, I want this farmland that is sitting in this trust. Follow me?
Right.
And the only creditor that you can have on your farmland then is if you have a purchase money mortgage or you have the land mortgaged. That you can never expunge at death. It's still subject to a mortgage, of course.
Okay.
But you would avoid outside creditors. You would avoid a public piece of information out there in the world.
Okay.
And two, you can go a lot faster. Three, you can go a lot faster.
Okay.
And winding up the affairs of an estate through a trust.
All right. Thank you very much.
Right, my pleasure.
Just to ask kind of a final question here, on average, how long does it take to probate a will?
Well, it depends on how complicated it is, but typically you're going to be tied up for a minimum of 6 months, and it could even be, I've seen cases of 3, 4, 5 years, depending upon how complicated things are.
Okay. Well, any last thing you'd like to leave folks with?
Interest rates are steady. If you are in a adjustable rate mortgage and you're looking at a 2% increase around the corner, fixed interest rates are very competitive. Looking today, I see them below 6%. So if you are thinking of locking in a long period of time in a mortgage and you're sitting in a variable, it's not too late. There's still a strong window of opportunity. We're seeing 20, 30-year amortized mortgages in the 5.875 to 6% range. Very good rate. Very, very good rate. Very fair rate. Makes a lot of sense if you have an adjustable rate mortgage.
All right. Well, we will leave it there for this time around. Our guest, David Sino, is clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. On Friday, once a month, he stops by here. We talk about personal finance and money management, and we'll see you again next month.
Thank you, David. It's always fun.